We'll hear argument first this morning in number 86489, W.T. Langley versus Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Mr. Shockey, you may proceed.
Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This Court is called upon in this case first to resolve a question of statutory interpretation. What meaning do we give to 1823E? The FDIC naturally urges a very broad reading of the statute. The Langleys, whom I represent, argue a very restricted interpretation of that statute. In looking at past decisions of this Court relative to statutory interpretation questions, I note that this Court looks first at the language of the statute, then, if necessary, at the legislative history, finally at policy considerations, and I will take each of those in turn. The language of the statute says, no agreement which tends to diminish or defeat, et cetera, shall be valid as against the corporation. No agreement. That is a key word. The statute does not say no claims. The statute says no agreement. We can see that some of the things that were alleged by the Langleys in their original complaint are agreements that 1823E bars. Things such as the interest rate being supposed to have been different from what was in the note, the term of the loan that it wouldn't be due until the property was sold, and that the liability on the note was in rem. We concede those things. Those are agreements at variance with the documents. We do not, however, concede that representations made by the bank president, as alleged, relative to the acreage in the tract of land at question or as to the mineral acreage and the status of the mineral rights on the property.
Agree that that much land would be delivered?
Well, first, the bank,
did,
of course, wasn't the true seller.
Well, I know, but they made the deal. All right.
If Your Honor will refer to the mortgage itself, which is in the appendix at page 29, you will see the fact that there were 1,628.4 acres in the mortgage tract is specified in the mortgage.
Now, what do you want us to look at and where
on
do we find
page 29
it?
Of the appendix is, that's one of the pages of the mortgage. And if I recall, right in the middle of the page, there's a reference in the mortgage itself to the property containing 1,628.4 acres.
Yeah.
And you say that some substantially lesser acreage
was
in fact
conveyed. Yes, ma'am. If you'll recall from the allegations in our complaint, the Langleys alleged that the property, in fact, only contained 1,522 acres.
Yeah. Well, and in your complaint, did you seek to set aside the transaction or to simply counterclaim for the decreased value of the property?
We counterclaimed, if you'll recall, the suit began with a suit on the note by the bank. We filed suit in federal district court seeking to rescind the transaction and to collect treble damages under the RICO statute. This was prior to the time the bank closed. Our suit, as distinguished from all the other FDIC litigation that I've reviewed, and I've tried to review every FDIC case, our case was pending. Our case was pending at the time that the FDIC was appointed the receiver for Planners Bank.
Mr. Shockey,
yes,
it seems to me you're saying that a promise is an agreement, but a representation of present fact is not an agreement. It doesn't seem to me a promise is any more literally an agreement than is a representation of present fact. If you want to really be technical about it, an agreement requires an exchange of promises. I don't know why the fact that I say I will charge you so much interest is any more an agreement than is the fact that I say the land has so many acres.
Well, what the case boils down to at this point is and I'll explain to you how that's different.
That the promises are agreements, right?
Promises that Mr. Caulfield, as the president of the bank, had the capacity to deliver, if you will, interest rate, term of loan, and things of those nature. Okay? But Mr. Caulfield wasn't delivering the property. Actually, a customer of the bank, actually delivered the property, actually delivered the mineral interest. Mr. Caulfield was making representations about the quality of the thing that was to be the object of the sale, not necessarily things that would be as to the qualities and characteristics of the loan transaction itself.
Seeing that their customer would deliver so many acres.
Excuse me, Your Honor. I didn't follow your question.
Why wasn't the officer, the bank officer, promising that the bank's customer would deliver so many acres?
Well, we in fact contend that he was promising that there would be. He represented that the tract, that he was familiar with the tract,
yeah,
and that it would include that many acres of
property. Well, why wasn't that as much an agreement as anything else?
Well, Your Honor, it's the representations as to how many acres there would be and how many mineral rights you would get were an ingredient, if you will, of the sale between Lienert's Farms, who was the other bank customer, and my clients. Representations as to interest rate, term of loan, and that sort of stuff were an ingredient of the loan transaction. You actually have two transactions between different parties.
Well, the promises that you now rely upon were, or the representations that you now rely upon, were apparently made by the actual owner of the property who sold it to your client?
No. We allege they were made by the bank president. If you
the
recall,
owner of the property never said he had 1,600 acres or whatever it was?
I believe it's alleged in our complaint that the Langleys met the seller at the closing.
And the document at closing included this document that you called our attention to?
The documents at closing included a sale agreement, a deed, possibly you may refer to it, common law, which is included in the appendix.
For that number of acres?
Right. And a separate document, a mortgage, or which is the lien instrument under Louisiana law, which also contains the reference to the 1,628.4 acres. Both instruments contain that reference.
I must confess I'm kind of puzzled. Why wouldn't that have given them the adequate information about the size of the tract?
Well, the problem is there was a representation.
An oral statement earlier that there was more acreage. Is that it?
No, there's less acreage. Actually, a survey, as we allege in a complaint, reveals there's less acreage.
Less than 1628?
Yes, sir. I believe the exact figure is 1522, as alleged in the complaint.
But why do you have to rely on an oral statement about 1628? That's in the written document.
Well, I understand, but the mortgage itself is not in the form sanctioned by the statute, as in approved by the Board of Directors and this and that and the other.
Yeah, but it surely cleared up any — I mean, it surely made it clear that that's the amount of acreage they
were buying. Well, it surely makes it clear that that's what the Langleys thought they were buying. I agree with you there.
I don't understand, then, why you have to rely on an oral statement.
Well, I would love to rely on my mortgage, you know, and if the court would rely on my mortgage, I would be very enthralled. But the point is, I don't think the mortgage itself fits the requirements under 1823E. You've got to have not only a writing, but you've also got to have it approved by the board and this and that and the other.
Well, in the mortgage, I assume the representation as to the acreage is a representation from your client to the bank rather than a representation from the bank to your client.
Yes and no.
Isn't that right? I mean, does the ordinary mortgage, if there's something wrong with the acreage and it's less than indicated, is it the bank that's somehow responsible?
The answer to your question is yes and no, and I will explain. You get to a question of state law there. You get to a question of who the lawyer who prepared the mortgage instrument is actually representing. Now, we allege in our complaint that the lawyer who prepared the mortgage instrument was the bank's lawyer. He was the lawyer for the bank. So you get to a state law question at that point in terms of who's representing to who.
In the mortgage, by the way, that also wouldn't be an agreement either, the representation as to the what the acreage is.
The representation contained in the mortgage, okay, you know, that's a document prepared from, if you'll look, prepared from the sale document. They have the same appendix with the property description. So I'm not sure we can characterize that as an agreement. It's a document, you know, of course, prepared by the attorney who was representing the bank.
Mortgage is an agreement, certainly, but you would say that that portion of the mortgage consisting of the representation that there are so many acres in the land, that's not an agreement in and of itself.
That's what I believe, yes, sir.
Well, ordinarily, a representation or warranty, whatever you want to call it, in a mortgage like that, runs from the mortgagor to the mortgagee. It would run, as someone said earlier, from your client to the bank and not vice versa.
Right. And, of course, where did my client get the information? He got it from the bank.
Well, what has happened to your lawsuit against the bank president and the bank?
The bank president, for your information, went into bankruptcy. And the bankruptcy proceeding, his discharge, has been stayed pending the final outcome of the case.
And that is still pending.
That is still pending.
Presumably, your client could get some kind of adjustment or recovery in that lawsuit.
Assuming the gentleman is solvent. But, of course, as I indicated, he has gone into bankruptcy. His discharge has been stayed pending the final resolution of this case, be it in this court or following a remand.
Shaggy, tell me if I'm mistaken about what you're saying. In the ordinary contract, any representation of a material fact is automatically a condition upon the performance of the other party. If that representation isn't complied with, the other party doesn't have to perform. Now, if you make a representation and don't express the condition is implied anyway. It simply is implied in fact. Now, suppose the condition in this case had been expressed. And instead of the banks just saying the land contains so many acres, the bank says, I agree that if the land does not contain so many acres, you will have no obligation under this contract. Would that be an agreement?
That would be an agreement.
So the only failure here is what distinguishes an agreement from a non-agreement is spelling out the condition that exists anyway, whether you spell it out or not. That's the line you would have us draw.
I believe that's the conclusion that we're left with.
Yeah, I think that is. You're comfortable with that?
Well, obviously I'm not comfortable with the superholder and due course statute. Yeah. The statute's mean. It's tough. It's not fair. It's really not fair to the Langleys because their suit was pending 7 months prior to the time the bank was closed. Basically, what this court's got to determine is what is and what isn't beyond the scope of 1823E. We have briefed to death the question of what is a representation, what is a warranty, all that. I mean, we couldn't cite another source other than possibly my mother or something like that. I think what you've got to do is picture in your mind W.T. Langley and Roy Caulfield standing in the lobby of the Planners Bank in Opelousas, Louisiana, and think how this transaction went down, how... You know, what must one have said to the other and in what context? Glean from the allegations of the complaint. I simply don't have time to go through it. But if you will think of that in your mind, I think you will come to have a better appreciation of what was agreed upon between the gentlemen and what was in fact just represented and taken for granted by the other.
Mr. Shockey, let me pursue this same inquiry from a slightly different direction. Are the representations that are the focus of your petition here matters that would be defenses not available to a holder in due course under a uniform commercial code approach in ordinary commercial law?
Our defenses...
Would they be things like warranties that normally would not be available against a holder in due course?
They would not be available against a holder in due course who was otherwise a legitimate holder in due course, took for value, no default, et cetera.
And what we have here is a statute that automatically makes the FDIC a holder in due course in legal effect, don't we?
Except for two things. Okay, and let me respond to your question twofold. Your statute... Mind you, the FDIC, in a general sense, is going to take these problem loans where they are defaulted. So holder in due course loans wouldn't apply anyway, where they're in default. I'm saying the FDIC, you get these problem loans, they're in default. And, of course, if a loan's past due, a note's past due, you can't be holder in due course. The representations that we're keying upon are really the representations that induced Mr. Langley to buy the property, not necessarily the representations that induced him to make the loan. You've got to remember, the sale was between Leinert's Farms and Mr. Langley. The loan transaction was between Mr. Langley and the bank. I refer this case to its recent decision in Sedema regarding strict construction of language. Basically, the
Mr.
court Jackson, there...
Before you get into the legal argument, can I ask you a question about the facts? Is the agreement of October 3, 1980 in the papers before us?
I believe so, Your Honor.
I can't seem to find it.
No, sir, it's not in the appendix. It is in the record, of course.
It is in the record.
I do believe so, Your Honor.
Does it contain the normal boilerplate that all prior representations are merged into the agreement?
Frankly, I cannot recall the provisions of the instrument in that specificity. I'd like to refer you, as indicated, to the Sedema case. That's about the last pronouncement of this court that I'm familiar with regarding statutory construction. Also refer this court to the dissent written in the Philadelphia Gear case, Philadelphia Gear versus FDIC. Justice Marshall wrote at that time, "Nevertheless, to reach this common sense result, the court must read qualifications into the statute that do not appear there. We recently recognized that even when the ingenuity of businessmen creates transactions in corporate forms not contemplated by Congress, the courts must enforce the statutes Congress has written." Look at the words of the statute. Now, legislative history.
Still is a question of what does an agreement mean?
What is an agreement? That is a question. Mm-hmm.
And you say it means a promise.
But it does not mean representations as to the quality of the thing that is the subject of another transaction between the borrower and another party.
More precisely, you say it means only express promises, because when you make a representation of a material fact, there is an implied promise that the deal is off if that fact isn't true. What you're saying is that an agreement consists only of an express promise and not of an implied promise.
I don't follow your point.
I sell you a car, and I say the car has, I warrant this car has 8 cylinders. Okay. If it doesn't have 8 cylinders, turns out to have 4, you could rescind the transaction because there is implicit in that representation a promise that if it doesn't have 8 cylinders, you can get out of the transaction. What you're saying here is that unless that promise is made express, it is not an agreement. If it's express, I promise that if it doesn't have 8, you can get out of the transaction. If I make that express, you say it's an agreement, but if I leave it to be implied, it's not an agreement.
But the difference between your analogy and our case is you're talking about you selling to me, 2 parties, this transaction.
Right.
The party making the representation is the seller. In our case, the party making the representation was not the seller. The seller is somebody else. Roy Caulfield had no obligation, implied or otherwise, to make representations about the qualities of the thing.
But you're claiming that that representation goes to the validity of the deal between your client and the bank. You're saying it has something to do with that deal.
Certainly.
It was part of that transaction as
Certainly.
Well, wasn't it?
Certainly. We look at legislative history only if the language of the statute is unclear. That this court mentioned in the Blum versus Stinson case. The legislative history is sparse. Most of the legislative history that's available for the court is actually testimony given by members of the FDIC and their counsel at committee hearings. The Langleys had no lobby in Washington in 1950.
Well, are you trying now to show us that though the word agreement in the statute doesn't mean what one would ordinarily think agreement would mean?
Well, I think it means what one would ordinarily think agreement means.
Well, then why do you have to go to the legislative history?
Because I'm sure legislative history is going to be relied upon by my opponent.
Okay.
Your opponent will say the same thing, no doubt. So we have to get into legislative history. Right.
Most of the legislative history is sparse on this act, more so than any that I can recall before. Maybe it's a time. This court has indicated, and most of it has indicated, is FDIC personnel.
Well, isn't what you're trying to say, or perhaps you've already succeeded in saying it, rather, is that there is a difference between an agreement, as contained in statute, and a representation that is fraudulent that would be a basis for setting aside the transaction?
That's what I'm saying. Because under, you know, at least under Louisiana law, and we have the civil code, but the idea of fraud is not that much different from what I learned in law school about the common law. Under our law, If there's fraud and it induces you into the transaction, then it's as if you didn't give your consent. It erases, it vitiates, we use that word, the consent. And without consent, there can be no agreement, because an agreement is an accord of two minds and two wills.
Would you have won if this had occurred in the 11th Circuit?
I think so. I think Gunner, I would have won. I had the missing factual links that were not apparent in Gunner, because if you will recall, in Gunner, the borrowers conceded that the FDIC had no knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And also, of course, you had...
FDIC knew the facts here.
Yes, sir. As the appendix will reflect, the suit was filed well before the bank was closed, and the pendency of the suit was noted in two examination reports by the FDIC rendered prior to the time the bank closed. That is a fact that distinguishes this case from every other FDIC case that I know about.
I don't understand you're injecting fraud into the analysis all of a sudden. Whether it's an agreement or not depends upon the presence of fraud. You can have a fraudulent promise. There can be fraud in a transaction that consists of making a promise at the outset that you have no intention whatever to perform.
Well, that's true.
Well,
such as, for example, I'm going to give you an interest rate less than what's specified in the note. I'm going to tie it to Chase.
And you think that prevents it, that would prevent it from being an agreement within the meaning of this statute?
Yes, sir.
Well, then why have you waived your rights on those other two? I thought originally those promissory elements you contested as not being agreements. I thought on this appeal you've acknowledged that they are agreements.
Well, all of the federal circuit courts have uniformly recognized that sort of representation, if you will, the Gunner Court went to the point of trying to distinguish between promissory fraud and fraud that did not involve a promise to deliver at some future point in the time. I believe the issue in Gunner was one of the issues in Gunner was, as an example, was to make certain loans in the future, or it was in one of the other cases. So the federal circuit courts have uniformly held against me on that point, all of them. So when I came through the Fifth Circuit, I was in a position of having to concede that point. And I came to this court on the difference between the Gunner case and my case.
Well, you would most like us to say, then, that any fraud, whether it's promissory fraud or fraud in a representation which is not an express promise, any fraud can't constitute an agreement. And failing that, you would fall back on the fact that at least an implied promise is not an agreement. Is that?
I would love for this court to so hold. And basically, you know, I can live with Gunner. If this court would adopt Gunner and apply it to the facts of this case, I can live with that. That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Legislative history, really not of much help. The way to be afforded remarks made in legislative debate by others other than the drafter or the sponsor, this court has indicated is entitled very little weight. Further, that even the contemporaneous remarks of one legislator speaking about the purposes or intentments of enactment, this court has previously recognized.
Mr. Shockey, I suppose that even if the statute didn't cover it, that we would fall back on the holding of the Dench case. You think the statute replaced that old common law holding?
I think the statute replaces that common law holding.
Has any court so held?
No, sir.
No.
No, ma'am.
In fact, haven't they gone ahead and applied that case?
There have been some federal circuit courts that have applied that. Now, either I'm missing the boat or my client ought to pay me double for my brilliance, but I haven't seen the first time that anybody has brought up in those cases the preemption question. Nobody has, to my knowledge, in those reported decisions, urged that 1823E supplants the Dench case. Haven't seen it. And hopefully I shouldn't be penalized for that. I do believe federal common law still has application here. It has application for purposes of interpreting 1823E, just as you had noted in the Philadelphia Gear case that you look to federal law to determine what is a deposit, quote unquote, for purposes of another statute under the Federal Deposit Insurance Act in determining whether or not the corporation would be required to make good on a deposit. We can accept that federal common law applies. We do not concede that federal common law would apply in this case in terms of other defenses. Basically, the U.S. Kimball Foods case announced a three-pronged test for determining whether or not federal common law or state law should apply. I think if you will look at that case in light of the facts of this case, you will find that a state law rule of decision in terms of the fraud issue can be formulated that would not do violence to the federal policies and would have.
Thank you, Mr. Shockey. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Taranto.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The question in this case is whether federal law permits petitioners to rely on an unrecorded oral understanding to defeat their straightforward written obligation to repay to the FDIC more than $450,000 in borrowed money. That question has two parts because there are two sources of federal law, Section 1823E and federal common law. Our primary position is that Section 1823E requires petitioners to live up to their written obligation. Our secondary position is that federal common law requires the same result. There are two central reasons for both of our positions. First, it is necessary to the successful functioning of the federal deposit insurance system. Thus, longstanding federal policy and the basic functioning of that system as Congress intended it require that the FDIC be entitled to rely on the bank's written documents. Second, it is fair. With regard to who should bear the burden of the $450,000 at issue here, this case presents a choice between petitioners on the one hand, who borrowed the money, and the FDIC insurance fund and possibly other creditors on the other hand.
Well, Mr. Trotter, you say it's fair, but do you really think Congress meant to totally repeal the doctrine of fraud and the inducement as applied to this kind of transaction?
I think what Congress intended to do in Section 1823E was, in effect, to give by law the status of a holder in due course to the FDIC. And that status would, as Justice O'Connor suggested, preclude the assertion of personal defenses, including fraud and the inducement.
Fraud in the factum, so-called, survives.
That's right.
Holder in due course status. How do you distinguish that kind of fraud from fraud in the inducement?
Fraud in the factum, as I understand it, occurs when one person fraudulently induces somebody to sign a different document from the document that person thought they were signing. So it is akin to forgery or duress, but is different from what is alleged here, which I think is expressly in the complaint termed fraud in the inducement, that representations were made fraudulently that induced them to then sign a document that they had no difficulty reading or understanding.
Are there any factual misrepresentations by a bank officer that could ever give the borrower a real defense under the statute, in your view?
There could be fraudulent there could be fraud in the execution of an obligation assumed by the bank when it granted a loan. There's a case from the Ninth Circuit called FDIC against MEO in which a bank promised when being given a note to use the proceeds to purchase certain voting stock, I think in the bank or in some corporation, and instead purchased non-voting stock. The court said that was enforceable against the FDIC because the maker of the note was not negligent in failing to discover that the bank had fraudulently failed to do what it said it was going to do.
Should it make any difference that the FDIC in this instance did have actual knowledge before it took over the assets?
We don't see how an actual knowledge requirement can be read into the statute. The statute simply says that no agreement that tends to diminish the value of an asset obtained by the FDIC shall be valid against the FDIC. And it doesn't make any distinction according to whether the FDIC knew on the eve of the bank closing, perhaps by getting a telegram, as has happened, from somebody saying, hey, I have some objection to this defense. And in fact, no court, not one to my knowledge, has suggested an actual knowledge requirement in the context of Section 1823E. When some courts have gone on past 1823E and discussed the scope of federal common law protections, several of them have discussed an actual knowledge requirement. As it happens, in Gunter itself, an actual knowledge requirement was discussed, but there it was satisfied.
Mr. Toronto, can a fraudulent promise, a promise that the promisor has no intention of performing, can that constitute fraud in the inducement?
I think it can constitute fraud in the inducement, but it would not be a permitted defense under 1823.
Well, I understand, but my point is that even if we accept the interpretation of the word agreement that the petitioner would have us adopt, we would not have succeeded in establishing fraud in the inducement as a defense.
That's right. As I understand petitioner's distinction and the distinction that the Gunter Court alluded to and then the Sixth Circuit in the Hatmaker case more explicitly adopted, that distinction would say that certain kinds of fraud in the inducement are barred by 1823E, but certain other kinds are not, depending on whether the fraudulent representation was a factual representation or was a promise to do something. That distinction, too, we think is simply inconsistent with the policies behind 1823E, those policies being designed to allow the FDIC to look at the bank records and take those records at face value and not have to look outside the bank document.
Toronto, why aren't those policies equally implicated by a fraud in the execution?
The policies, as we understand them, are designed to allow people who make, who assume obligations, make a note in this case, to insist that any term that they think is relevant to the note be placed in writing. There are certain cases like fraud in the execution.
I understand that, but from the point of view of the FDIC, does it really make any difference whether the facts are as your opponent alleges here, or to just change them a little bit, supposing the bank president wrote up an agreement with the different sized acreage and it showed it to him, says this is what the deal is going to be, then he went home and substituted a page without telling him. And what shows up in the files is what we've got. Why, from the point of view of the FDIC, why is one any more, any different from the other?
Well, we do think that the statute places some limitations on the FDIC's protections. The FDIC can't simply say, it can't win in all cases regardless of facts. The emphasis in the statute on the writing.
It seems ironic to say that, and you say actual knowledge doesn't matter, that in one case, actual knowledge of the FDIC, they still can prevail. The other case, they don't know, but they'll lose.
Well, we think the critical distinction is whether the borrower had an opportunity to place in writing conditions he relied on and failed to exercise that opportunity. That's a distinction that we think comes out of the Dench case, which spoke about a borrower, not even a borrower.
He had the opportunity in the fraud in the execution case, too.
But as I understand your fraud in the execution case, the borrower didn't have any opportunity to prevent the bank from doing what later turns out to be a fraud, as in the Mio case.
Well, Mr. Toronto, don't you, at some point you have to come within the terms of the statute? What is your argument that makes these agreements?
Well, we think that any basis of the bargain, any representations, whether they're factual or promissory, constitute warranties, which in ordinary commercial law are agreements. We also think that the fraudulent intent behind any of those representations cannot be relevant because this rule, like a holder in due course rule, is intended to protect third parties. And where third parties are the object of the protection, the objective words exchanged are what has to matter. And as I suggested, that's a view that we think is supported, first of all, by petitioner's concession at every level in this case, that if
but the wouldn't the fraud in the execution that Justice Stevens mentioned to you qualify as an agreement in those terms?
Well, if I understand that fraud in the execution example, that may well be a real defense in Holder and Due Course doctrine.
Well, I know, but the statute doesn't say anything about Holder and Due Course. It says an agreement. And if the bank says, here's what you're going to sign, and then substitutes another document, there's been an agreement. There's been a representation.
Well, I'm not
That's
sure.
That sounds to me like it's as much as an agreement as
I'm not sure that in that case the asset would be one that the petitioner can fairly be said to have obliged himself under. So that, however one fits that example into the language of the statute, there has never been any attempt by the FDIC to depart radically from the basic distinction in Holder and Due Course doctrine between the personal and the real defenses. It is only when a borrower has an opportunity to protect himself, fails to take it, that we think the statute applies, that there is an agreement that cannot be valid against the corporation.
And one of the conditions to establish fraud in the execution, as I recall, is that the person asserting it not have had an opportunity to detect the fraud. That is, he can't come in and say, you know, the agreement that was presented to me was not the one I thought I was signing. I mean, the court would simply say, well, you know, was it given to you? And were you given an opportunity to read it? And if he said yes, fraud in the execution wouldn't apply. Would it? There has to be some chicanery that deprives him of the opportunity to see what he's executing.
Well, that would certainly be one way of accommodating that exception.
Well, I don't know if it's a way of accommodating. Am I right on the law? Is that...
As I understand, that is the essential rationale behind most, if not all, of the real defenses, forgery, duress, and whatnot.
Just repeating what the Chief Justice asked you earlier, Congress probably, you think Congress had this distinction in mind?
There's no evidence specifically in the legislative history.
Or in the statute.
Or in the statute that Congress surveyed the whole range of questions that could arise when the FDIC seeks to enforce a note that it obtains from the bank. And I might add at this point that that's the primary reason why we think any argument about preemption of common law, if we were to get to that, cannot survive. That is, whatever Congress was doing in passing Section 1823E, they were not saying, let's think about all possible defenses and then specify these defenses and only these defenses are to be forbidden. They simply addressed what I think they understood to be one problem, a problem that grew out of the Dench case and more specifically, as we showed in our brief, out of a Third Circuit case that prompted the introduction of the legislation. Now, it is true that our position, by reading Section 1823E to grant the FDIC holder in due course status as a matter of law, puts the FDIC in a much more favorable position than the bank itself would be in. But as Justice Jackson said in the Dench decision, the corporation, the FDIC, did not simply step into the shoes of local banks. The purposes sought to be accomplished by it can be accomplished only if it may rely on the integrity of banking statements and banking assets. Now, that reliance is critical at least two different places in the overall deposit insurance system.
But when you talk about the integrity of banking statements and so forth, ordinarily that would not be thought to suggest that a statement of a bank showing a note payable for $300,000 was free of any defenses like fraud and the inducement. You wouldn't say that statement lacked integrity if they showed on their statement a note for $300,000. There may be defenses to a note like that.
As against the bank?
Yes.
Yes, and as against the bank officers in this case, a fraud defense not only could be asserted, but has been asserted and remains alive in this case.
So I don't see why you get into the a sense of integrity of the bank statements.
Oh, I think that what Justice Jackson had in mind when referring to the integrity of banking statements was that the FDIC, in its several roles as examiner of the institution and then as the insurer that steps in once a bank fails, must be able to take those bank statements, in effect, at face value, the way a holder in due course would take a note purchased in good faith at face value.
But
no one else would read them.
But the inference from that observation would be that if the FDIC knows that that there is no integrity to the bank statement, why should they win if they know that this is a false statement?
I think there's a statutory answer and then a policy answer. The statutory answer is that an actual knowledge requirement simply, we think, cannot be fitted into the language of 1823E. The policy answer, and all the courts have agreed with that, the policy answer is that unlike an ordinary holder in due course or a good faith purchaser, the FDIC is not in a position simply to walk away from the transaction. The FDIC has certain obligations. One way or the other, it is affected by the value of this asset. Either it has to pay the deposit insurance up to $100,000 for each depositor, or it has to infuse some of its own money into the system either to assist the bank or to arrange for a new bank to take over the failed institution. But the FDIC cannot simply, upon hearing that there's a problem with the asset, say, I won't have anything to do with it. The FDIC is, in effect, an involuntary creditor, and the protections should accordingly be stronger than in the ordinary holder in due course case.
Mr. Toronto, the old common law rule under the Dench case, would that yield any different result, possibly?
I think that there are situations in which the Dench rule would cover, that it would cover certain situations that, in our view, 1823E would not
what
cover.
What type of situation?
Well,
would
it? Principally, it applies, it has been held consistently to apply to the FDIC acting in its capacity as receiver. There are, in fact, very few cases that apply Dench where, in our view, 1823E would not apply. There may be some situations, for example, where a failed bank has played the lead role and a loan participation has been arranged. In many situations, the participating bank has some kind of informal understanding that if the borrower defaults, then the loan participation comes to an end and the lead bank has to take it back. What the FDIC is presented with in that situation is simply the lead bank's participation, and the participant bank is coming in and saying not that that asset should be diminished, but that the bank has to take on a new obligation that doesn't appear in the books. We think that that, too, would be a situation that would be covered by Dench because the bank, the participant bank, would have lent themselves to a transaction that was likely to mislead bank examiners. But on the whole, in our view, Section 1823E, as to the FDIC in its corporate capacity, does in fact cover what Dench covers. Now, the role that this statute plays, if read as entitling the FDIC to rely on bank records as a holder in due course would, comes into play, first of all, in with respect to the FDIC's role with open banks. And that role is chiefly to ensure that those banking institutions don't, in the end, threaten the solvency of the fund. Congress has given the FDIC extensive powers to examine banks, and what is critical is that in those examinations, the FDIC examiners be able to rely on the books and records of the banks as they appear and not have to begin interviewing people outside the bank, investigating the particular law of Louisiana in this case, and making its own assessment, not about the practical collectability of particular assets, but about their legal enforceability if on their face they appear to be fully valid. The second place in the system that this ability to rely on bank records is critical is when a bank fails. Now, when a bank, an insured institution, fails, the FDIC has several options. But it has long been recognized that the preferred option is not to close the bank and pay off depositors, but to try to keep the bank open. And that is done through a purchase and assumption transaction, whereby another bank, usually in the community, takes over the failed institution. That's preferable for a number of reasons. For one, all depositors are fully paid and not simply up to their $100,000. It keeps the bank open and avoids disruption of banking services in the community. And it preserves the going concern value of the bank. An assuming bank is typically willing to pay some substantial amount of money to get new branches. And Congress itself has recognized these advantages. Even recently, this summer, since the briefing in this case was completed, Congress added yet a new method by which the FDIC can keep a bank open, creating the possibility of a temporary bridge bank in Title V of the Competitive Equality Banking Act of 1987. Now, what's critical is that although that option is preferred under the statute, it may be exercised only if it's less costly than the principal alternative, simply closing the bank and liquidating it. And the ability to rely on the written assets of the bank is critical in three respects at this stage. First of all, of course, it increases the value of those assets and makes the preferred option more likely to be taken. Second of all, the determination of which option may be taken, that is, the assessment of which option is more or less costly, must be made very quickly. And that means that simply as a matter of ensuring the accuracy of the determination, the FDIC should be able to rely on the bank's records. And finally, when the bank fails, the question is not whether a loss is going to be avoided entirely. The question is who will bear the loss. Now, it's possible that in this case, Mr. Caulfield or the other bank official involved can successfully be sued, and petitioners will not have to bear this loss. But as between petitioners and the FDIC, it seems to us quite clear who should bear that loss, because petitioners had an opportunity to protect themselves by insisting that these terms be placed in writing. And the FDIC, of course, did not. The FDIC came in after the transaction was completed. Here, in addition, it should be noted that unlike in the Dench case, all we're talking about is whether petitioners must repay money that wasn't theirs to begin with, that was borrowed from the bank. In the Dench case, this court precluded a defense by the maker of an accommodation note and required that person to pay money that was his to begin with that he had not borrowed. So we think fairness considerations, as well as the requirements of the FDIC system, require the same result. Let me say a word finally about the common law issue. As I have mentioned,
do you think the result in Dench would have been different if the FDIC had known that the note was really not a note at all? It was a spurious note.
We think Dench either expressly or all but expressly says that the result would not have been different, because it says that whether bank examiners were in fact deceived or not is simply irrelevant to the issue. The only requirement for deciding that the note maker as opposed to the FDIC fund should bear the loss is that the note maker lent themselves to a transaction that would tend to deceive bank examiners. If those facts are enough, then an actual knowledge requirement is simply irrelevant. Now, briefly on the common law issue. Our first point, as we suggested in our brief, is that 1823E cannot be read as a preemption of common law. of common law making power of the federal courts in these kinds of cases.
Well, do you ordinarily speak of that sort of thing as preemption?
Well, I think some of this court's cases have spoken about it as preemption. It is not preemption in the same sense as federal preemption of state law. What we have here is a general jurisdictional grant by Congress, and a Section 1819(4) says that any case involving the FDIC arises under federal law. There is no suggestion in the legislative history, we think, or in the statute itself, that what Congress was doing here was like what it was doing in the principal cases relied on by petitioners. Congress did not, as I've suggested, survey the entire realm of possible defenses and make a considered judgment that these and only these defenses were to be precluded and all other defenses available under state law were to be recognized. And we think that once the issue of preemption is out of the way and that it is acknowledged that if 1823E does not itself cover the facts here, that the common law-making powers of this court should lead the court to reach the same result that the Fifth Circuit reached on statutory grounds. Under the Kimball Foods analysis, all three factors, we think, lead to that result. First, there is a need for uniformity in the federal rule because there is a single nationwide deposit insurance fund that is threatened every time there is a $500,000 loss threatened. Second, federal policies, as I've tried to explain them and as they are reflected in 1823E, would be frustrated by disabling the FDIC from relying on bank records. Excuse me. And finally, we don't think that there would be a serious interference with private practices based on state law. And the principal reason for that is that when an individual deals with a bank, the norm is that obligations and promises and representations be placed in writing.
Well, the bank is subject to the same fraud laws in most states as any other. If they lie or deceive, a transaction can be set aside.
This
certainly changes that.
It certainly does, but it is common in both the common law and for now 40 years in federal law with respect to the FDIC for those who come in after a bank fails to be in a better position, whether they're a receiver or
of course, since you never know whether a bank is going to fail, it just alters a very substantial part of the ordinary common law governing fraud, doesn't it?
Well, the considerations that an individual would ordinarily be expected to take into account should include the considerations about what will happen if the bank fails, just as somebody buying a security of some type from a corporation should take into account priority rules that may occur if the corporation goes into bankruptcy.
It may be a desirable result, but I don't think it's accurate to say nothing would be changed if we did that.
Well, the principal change, we think, would be exactly the one that Congress intended to encourage in 1823E, which is to add an extra measure of encouragement for people when dealing with banks to place everything that they understand to be a basis of the bargain in writing. The Court has no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Toronto. Mr. Shockey, you have 4 minutes remaining.
When this bill that became this act moved through the legislative process, it was amended on the House floor, as I recall, to change the word, which was simultaneously in the original draft, talking about when this agreement must be placed in writing and all that sort of stuff, to the word contemporaneously. Representative Walker handled the case on the bill on the legislative floor, and he had some remarks which are important not only for purposes of 1823E and what does the statute mean, but also for federal common law. He said in part, and this is from 96 Congressional Record 10731 and 32, he said in part, "Prior hereto and up to the time of an unfortunate interpretation of the law, it was believed that all legal agreements entered into by the bank and obligor were binding on the corporation, FDIC. He goes on, page 732. It was never the intention of Congress to give the corporation a stronger position than that of the bank, and the adoption of the amendment, my amendment, is offered to prove heretofore it was the intent of Congress that any agreement in the absence of fraud is binding on the corporation. This is a fraud case, gentlemen. Ladies, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shockey. The case is submitted.